I'm here in the studio today with Darj Mail, an investigative journalist who's got a new book out on climate change called The End of Ice. Dar, you have come a long way to get up to this point, and next week you're actually going to be in the sanctuary hosting a workshop on April 16th. But before you wrote on climate disruption, you spent a long time reporting on the Iraq war. Can we just take a minute to establish for our listeners the general trajectory that has brought you to this point?
You bet. It really started back in 1996 when I moved to Alaska, at which point I started spending a lot of time in the mountains, which means I was immediately faced with pretty dramatic impacts from runaway climate disruption that were already happening. Dramatically receding glaciers, freaky weather events like no snow on the ground in Anchorage during Christmas time, etc. So that seed was planted that there was a huge problem long before I even started working as a journalist and went to Iraq. But then, of course, the war happened, and that's how I started my career as a journalist and then stayed on that track for the next 7 years from 2003 to 2010. And then when the BP oil spill happened in the Gulf of Mexico, I knew I was already keen to get on the climate change beat, and that was really my segue into environmental journalism, and then very shortly thereafter into climate disruption, which now I've been writing about for nearly 10 years.
So tell us about the new book that you have out, The End of Ice.
It's a book where I really took a similar template from my first Iraq book, which the whole point of that book was to go out to the front lines and report back to people exactly how the occupation was impacting the lives of Iraqi people. And similarly, I went out to the front lines of some of the hot spots on the planet of where the impacts of runaway climate change are happening the most dramatically and the fastest. So places like the Great Barrier Reef in Australia, where I was there the first week of another major bleaching event that struck that reef back in 2017. I went back up Denali, a place where I'd spent a lot of time when I was living in Alaska, and wrote about disappearing glaciers, to St. Paul Island and the Pribilofs, about how native populations are being impacted, to the Amazon rainforest, to South Florida for sea level rises, and many other places. So the whole goal was to try to really give people a very personal experience of what it feels like to go to these places where the changes are happening so quickly, and write about it from a very personal perspective, as well as going out into the field with some of the leading scientists to bring home the most updated science we have about what's happening.
And going from the reporting on the Iraq war to climate change really seems kind of disparate. Where does conflict and climate disruption intersect?
Well, there's actually several places, the most obvious being that Iraq being a war for oil that should never be extracted from the ground and refined and then burned and emitted as CO2 emissions into the already overburdened atmosphere. So there's that direct link. And then, of course, we look at what's happening across the Middle East now and the conflicts there. You could argue confidently that climate disruption plays a very key role. For example, there was a 10-year drought leading up to the instability in Syria that then devolved into the conflict that we see now. It's well known that the Arab Spring was caused in large part by rainfall patterns shifting and worsening droughts and escalating food prices. That, you know, the spark that set that revolution alight was the vegetable vendor in Tunisia setting himself on fire in protest. And in Egypt, same thing. It was escalating food prices that caused the political destabilization to worsen there, and even leading to the ousting of dictator Hosni Mubarak. So there are many, many direct links to climate disruption and the wars across the Middle East, and continue to be. And certainly now, with the ongoing and worsening refugee crisis across the Mediterranean, that's yet another link.
You mentioned the ongoing refugee crisis. There's a lot of speculation that there will be that huge amounts of climate refugees in the near future. How do you see the political climate right now, you know, accepting these refugees, or how do you see the reaction to these refugees happening?
Well, we do see very disconcertingly this kind of raise the drawbridge, xenophobic, fear-based mentality that the current administration is exhibiting, which is deeply disconcerting. And we see humans being put in cages and demonized and dehumanized and all the horrible ensuing things that come along with that. So that's in full play in our headlines on a daily basis now, which is rather horrifying. And then, of course, we see that contrasted with this same administration that's doing everything that it can to deny the reality of human-caused climate disruption. And then we have the military itself that has consistently been saying that climate change poses the single greatest security threat to them on the planet, and they're already preparing for it. We have the Navy that's actively trying to figure out how to fortify and possibly even relocate many of its naval bases right on the coast, which are now starting to flood. So there's this also kind of strange, ironic incongruity between an administration that's doing what I discussed while having a military that is trying its best to actively prepare for the waves of onslaught of refugee crises and political instabilities across the world that are going to be exacerbated by climate change.
It almost seems like this disparate attitude between the administration and the military, where the military is preparing for this crisis and the administration is putting out this narrative of loosening environmental regulations, climate denial, this push towards a border wall and anti-immigration attitudes almost seems in anticipation of that flood of climate refugees. But unfortunately, many people that I've talked to are disillusioned with the voting system and don't participate. So what role would you say that voting and civic participation, or lack thereof, has played in climate disruption?
Well, that's a good question and a challenging one, because I am extremely cynical personally about the political process in this country. I think we have had ever since money has been allowed to be as heavily involved in our election cycle as it is now, I think any idea or hope of democracy functioning has gone by the wayside. That said, whether it's by voting or ideally by other means, the necessity for civic action at this point, I think it's never been a more critical time in this country. I think it far supersedes voting at this point. I think we are already at a point where a massive organized resistance or even a rebellion against what's happening, whether we're talking about the healthcare crisis or the education crisis or what's happening on the border or any number of probably hundreds of other critical issues that are on the front burner right now, the need for civic activism in a literal sense now is as great as it's probably ever been in this country.
Going back to you mentioned earlier, Native populations, you've been all around the world documenting the cascade effects of climate disruption and these Native populations that have been impacted by that. Can you go into a bit more detail? And did you observe these populations adapting to their changing environments?
Well, the place that I highlighted to really investigate this and really show the best I could how dramatically indigenous populations are being impacted was St. Paul Island and the Pribilof Islands in the Bering Sea off the coast of Alaska. And the Aleut people who live there, there's only a little over 200 of them that live year-round on St. Paul Island. They live a subsistence lifestyle, meaning they harvest shorebirds and fur seals for their subsistence lifestyle, as well as many of them being involved in the commercial fishing industry now. And with the warming North Pacific waters, we're seeing huge disruptions in the food chain, causing calamitous declines in the types of birds that the Aleutian people on St. Paul are relying upon, as well as dramatic decreases in the fur seal population. They are doing their best to adapt, but they're very, very concerned, and many of them are overtly afraid of these declines and what they see coming in the future, because it's not just because they're losing key food sources and key components to their economy, which they are, but their lifestyle, their culture, their spirituality, their storytelling, the passing along of their heritage is all the same thing, and it's all directly linked into the subsistence lifestyle. And so as that lifestyle gets impacted and eroded, literally their entire culture and way of being, including their language being passed on, storytelling, et cetera, all of that is being impacted. So that's what's at stake here. And with indigenous populations, since they typically are the peoples on the planet that are living much closer to the planet itself, they're the ones feeling the impacts the first and the most intensely.
Did you see any ways in which these populations were adapting?
Well, certainly they are trying to augment subsistence lifestyle in different ways, and they're doing things like making additional and renewed efforts to seeing what's happening. So, okay, for example, a class had been set up to start teaching the language because they knew that people weren't getting, children weren't getting out enough with the elders and being taught in the subsistence ways for the language and the culture to be passed along. So a class had been set up, and that was being used to promote the language and some of the storytelling and singing to augment what was being lost. So things like that, as well as they were trying to find ways to encourage more of their young people to stay on the island instead of leaving as soon as they became young adults. So there were certainly efforts being made to try to do their best to maintain a sense of continuity in the culture amidst this backdrop of the subsistence lifestyle being eroded.
It sounds like they're facing it with an attitude of solidarity.
Oh, without a doubt, because they certainly are acutely aware, as they have been now for generations since the Western colonial invasion of their lands, that banding together is paramount. That's the first step. That's first and foremost. If they're going to get through anything, they understand far better than others that if we don't band together, there's no way we're going to make it through this. So that's the first step, and they are certainly acutely aware of that.
Dar, we have just a couple minutes left, but experts call Arctic warming the smoking gun of the impending climate crisis, and new reports are showing that sea ice is melting more rapidly than we had initially anticipated, and these cascade effects will continue to accelerate. From your experiences and what you've observed, what are some ideas about how we can limit the extent of climate disruption through our activities and at the same time anticipate and prepare to adapt to our new climate reality?
Right. Those are really two of the key things that I talk about now when I'm out giving my book readings. It's mitigation, which is what can we do to slow the impacts. We're not going to stop anything at this point, but we can theoretically still slow things down. So if we took dramatic enough actions, for example, maybe we could limit the warming by 2100 instead of it hitting 5°C. Maybe we could limit that to 4°C, which would be massive, although still catastrophic. But yes, it's still our moral obligation to do so. And then that really leads us into adaptation at the same time. That I think, firstly, mentally, we have to adapt and accept that we're living in a dramatically new world now, and we have to prepare ourselves for that mentally and psychologically. And adaptation within our own communities, being acutely aware of, okay, we clearly have a federal government that's not going to do anything here to really work actively towards mitigation. So what can we start doing locally to do that? And of course, that starts personally in our own lives, but then hopefully that expands rapidly outward into our own communities. And that's what I'm trying to do where I live. And fortunately, we do have a very active community working along these lines. And I hope that that's something that is spreading across the country. And I do believe on a local level that that is what's happening.
Dar, just very quickly, can you give us a preview of your workshop, Be the Media, the Art of Investigative Journalism?
Well, I'm certainly going to come at this from working in a country that's moving rapidly into authoritarianism and having had a lot of experience working abroad in countries that were authoritarian regimes. I'm going to talk about that and the need to safeguard yourself and how to be smart operating within that environment, as well as against this backdrop of everything that we just discussed about living on a planet where things like food, water, and security, basic availability are going to be a thing that is going to become more common throughout even Western countries as we move into the future. So where does journalism fit into that as well?
Dar, thank you so much for joining us in the studio today, all the way from Olympia, Washington.
Correct.
Oh, my goodness.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. You can see Dar Jamail here at the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy on April 16th from 4 to 6 p.m. For Hudson Mohawk Magazine, I'm Alexis Goldsmith.